You are listening to Something Rather Than Nothing. Creator and host, Ken Vellante. Editor and producer, Peter Bauer.
That's kind of accented. What's going on there?
It's a new Dutch. New Dutch. All right. We're recording Something Rather Than Nothing, and we have as a guest tonight BK Tuan, a poet, professor, teacher, and somebody who I met a long time ago. We actually have kept in touch more or less, maybe online for a little bit amount of time, but certainly been forever since we talked. So this is a great, really excited to talk with you, BK, and reconnect, but also ask you some questions so I can learn more about, you know, what you create and what you do, but also, of course, you as a human being. And the first question I have is, you know, going back as a younger child, what were you like? How did you see your personality when you were younger, or how do you see it now?
I'll answer that question, but first, it's a pleasure and honor to be on this podcast. And yeah, it's been a long time. I think it was at 2000 or 2001. We were in Lucian Miller's Buddhism in America seminar, a graduate school at UMass Amherst. Is that right?
Absolutely. My daughter, to put it in a time frame, my daughter had just been born. She's going to the University of Oregon this fall, just to put it in context.
Congratulations. Wow. Wow. So what, 18, 19 years ago? That's incredible.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And I was just, you know, I didn't know what graduate school was like. But I, you know, in terms of answering your question. I came here to America when I was very young, and we first lived in Revere, Massachusetts, then we bought a home in Malden, which is another city over, and there weren't a lot of Cambodians in Malden at that time. And, you know, going through the various school systems in that area, I was pretty miserable. I was a loner, an outsider. It just did not fit in. I was very much alienated. In terms of what kind of a young person I was an outsider. And I think that shaped my the way I see the world, and I was looking for something to help me, to give me a sense of anchor, a sense of stability, a sense of a way of making sense of the world. And that was through reading. And as other writers have talked about, I'm sure many times before, you know, you get excited by a writer, and you read and read, and you exhaust the novels and the poetry, and then you start reading interviews, and then you start reading other writers you know, from that, and then you start emulating. You want it to be Bukowski, you want it to be Carver, you want it to be Hemingway, and then you get tired of those guys because they're sort of super macho, and then you gravitate toward other writers. And you know, the contemporary stuff now, they're pretty amazing and all over the place, and it's quite fascinating. Being very different, visibly different. My name is different from my peers' names. Everything. It shaped me in a way that some good and bad. In terms of the good stuff is, without it, I don't think I would have turned into the world of literature. But it was a lot of pain, a lot of suffering. So literature and music, those two art forms, they helped me, they sustained me, they kept me going. So I'm really a product of that, and the library too, the local library. But anyway, does that Did that sort of answer your question a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we had talked before, and you had mentioned about how that has really impacted what you create. And one of the things that I've found, maybe a supposition that I have, is that some folks are really just compelled to throw themselves into those art forms and, you know, and identifying as an outsider for whatever reason that is. It provides possibly a different vantage point or a different approach to creating art. At a certain point in your life, did you have a need where you needed to create what you created? Like, you didn't have a choice, or did you step aside and say, you know, I want to write some things, or I want to create this in order to process? I mean, did you feel compelled to do it, I guess, is the main question.
It started as sort of a kind of a psychological, emotional need. I wanted to talk about, you know, how I came to be, and the experience of the refugee experience have shaped me, and also being an orphan has shaped me. And I've been carrying all these stories, these feelings. And I really didn't know how to, how to express them, how to release them. So at first, it was really much about the need, to write about my experience. You know, then in the process of thinking about my life, I also started to think about my family, and. Just amazed in terms of what they went through and survived the Cambodian genocide and in refugee camps, and also the culture and racism of America. So I started not only to write about myself, I started to write about my family. Especially my grandmother. She was a mother to me. When my mother died, my grandmother took care of me and became my mother. So I write as a way to honor her memory, as a way to pay homage to her. And also about, you know, I write about my uncles and aunts. Again, as a way to document what they went through. So in addition to that, honoring and paying homage, but also to give them, a voice to tell their stories, because they can't tell their stories. Their English isn't good enough. They didn't have the kind of education that I have had. So there's that sense of obligation to family and then people in terms of, you know, Cambodian Americans. And then once I get through that, there's other sort of reasons for writing. But compulsion, obsession, all of those things sort of seem to drive me. Like even now, I still think about things and I still write, I still put them down. Now I write about my daughter, about being a father for the first time. I'm working on my third book of poetry, and that's all dedicated to my daughter. The experience of being a father to a girl during this new America, this America that is in a state of turmoil, this Me Too movement, this Time Out sort of movement, and then this anti-immigration sort of sentiment that's been happening, you know, for quite some time, but it has exploded, especially in the past 2-3 months. There's that sense of, you know, moving away from myself and family to the social, political realm. And then there's pleasure, man. There's this, the pleasure of reading and the pleasure of writing, of making something beautiful. So there's all kinds of, like, in terms of the need to write, it's and the reasons why I write, there's all kinds there.
Yeah, Yeah, and I've read both collections of your poetry, and it's really incredible writing. And what I took from it, the word family was big, because you did animate. I mean, I think, you know, when you're saying about, you know, trying to give voice, we hear that a lot, but it's very important. And I think you really do that consistently, like to write in such a way where the reader connects with like what this person was like or what they said. But both the when family is working well in passing along wisdom, or just basically the ability to survive, or what do we do, or sharing resources, or sharing food. But also when that is threatened, I think that, you know, the threat of, you know, of a diaspora and or being in a vulnerable state in a war-torn area, I mean, all those are attacks on that value, and that's, mm-hmm. you know, what's important. So I see that continually in your writing. You really get a sense of it, and I think it was in So I Was Blessed at the beginning, where where you're waiting for your daughter, and I think it was an homage to the she's on her way. So it's kind of like in time in place, and it's really powerful. So you get a sense of like, your creative process. Now you're a professor and teacher as well. As far as how those interrelate, do you see yourself operating smooth in the fashion of teaching, you know, writing and literature, but also doing it for yourself?
Yeah, I'm a very shy and quiet person in public. So my job is to stand in front of the classroom and ask questions, listen to students' views and perspectives and opinions, and engage in discussion. So I'm not a charismatic teacher, and I think that, you know, that has to do with sort of my own early background that I mentioned earlier. But also, but once you are teaching materials that are very personal and real to you, my sort of the key to overcoming that shyness is finding something that you're really passionate about. So there's a wonderful correlation between my scholarly work, which is looking at Southeast Asian narratives, poetry, autobiography, memoir, fiction, oral narratives, through the lens of war and immigration and home and identity and trauma and recovery and writing. It's all related to what I do in terms of my own creative work. So, you know, I kind of lucked out whether I was smart or just really, you know, fortunate to figure a way where the teaching, the scholarly work, and the creative writing, they're pretty much the same thing, or at least they're in different mediums. They're in different media, right? Each one of them is in different medium, and but at the same time, they're tackling similar issues and concerns. So you know, for me, you know, I talked about the same thing in the classroom as I explore in my own writing. So there's that, and I think students, even though they're really, I work at Union College, and it's a kind of place where when I first arrived, I experienced a kind of culture shock. a liberal arts college, a private college that seems so foreign to me. I didn't know such a thing existed before I arrived at Union, where students are you know, some of them are very, very privileged. They came from a very good background, economic background. So it's not just an issue of, racial differences, ethnic differences, but class differences that I experienced. But I think once you sort of teach in a way where the students, in spite of their differences, can relate to you on a human level, can relate and see that these things are very personal to you, I think that barrier is broken and you can connect. I don't know if that answer your question, but that's how I go about with writing and teaching and different kinds of writings that I do.
Yeah. It's interesting. You mentioned the piece about, with the private college and some of those things. Right before I had gone to the University of Massachusetts, before we met, I had gone to Marquette University, Jesuit school, a lot of class and all that, class issues and just being around a private institution. Like prior to that, I thought I would never actually attend a private school. It's actually still a strange concept to me. And it was a great experience, but it was a difficult experience, at the time with those adjustments. But it was one that was it was like being in a different world, and I'd imagine starting out and being on staff over there at Union. Of course, me being a Union labor movement guy, I love the name of the. what town is that in, BK? I forget.
In Schenectady, I thought so. Okay. New York. We're in the Albany and the Capital Region, not far from Albany.
Yeah. Yeah. A couple questions very specifically about, art as a concept. Sure. What is art?
That's a really big question. And I still don't really know what it is. I know that it's beautiful and pleasurable. I know that it connects me to the community, and also connects me to something more, something transcending, something eternal, something just transcending, something before culture and language. Sometimes I read a poem, and a good one would sort of put me in a kind of a good mental state. There's a sense of finding myself in a kind of still point in my life, and that's good stuff. So it's not just the social, political, cultural aspect of art, but there's also something that transcends that too. I don't have a definition. I know that it's just it has to do with beauty. It has to do with something that is transcending, but also connects me to the world, and then to the world that's beyond this world. I don't know if that makes sense, but
there's a lot that does. There's aspects of like how it impacts you emotionally, the sense of well-being that it gives you, the experience of the sublime or spiritual. I mean, there are aspects that you were talking about with the eternal. Those components are there.
Philosopher. Oh dear.
Yeah, well, I took a course with Dr. Cheryl Foster at the University of Rhode Island. I actually will be a guest on this show.
Great.
Yeah, and she taught a class called The Philosophy of Art. So, I'm asking you one question in an interview. I got 4 months to try to tackle it, but it's a great question, and one of which not all philosophers have grappled with. There's certain philosophical questions, like if you consider yourself a philosopher in history, you kind of like have to have an opinion on each subject, and artists, you know, the philosophers haven't always, not each philosopher has had like strong opinions on that. But if you go to back all the way to the Greeks, you know, and think about Plato's view of poetry, I mean, he had very bad things to say about poets, that they created, you know, kind of bad reflections of what was good and pure. So there's, you know, once you interrogate the question of art in a philosophical way, it becomes a lot of fun. So future episode, it will have her, and it's a great question. There's one actually related to you. There's Joanna Valente, who you've worked with before.
Hello.
Yeah, she is a future guest as well. And my understanding now that you had done some poetry, but also she had done some drawings or sketchings that went along with that. Could you talk about that process and what your intent and what you're trying to do with that?
Yeah, I would like to actually send her via email a list of questions about the process. You know, I was really interested in how she would I haven't thought about this very clearly, so the words might not be right, but how does she translate from one medium to another? You know, what does she notice? What does she pick up? How can she relate my experience of being a refugee Cambodian orphan in America? How does she relate to that otherness? Those are some questions that I really want her to tackle once she is done with her sketching, with her artwork. I kind of sort of sent her an email and see if she's interested, and I just sent her the poem. So it's not a situation where, you know, it goes back and forth, where there's a dialogue. Unfortunately, she's the one who's sort of responding to my poetry. It would be interesting if she were to sort of send me some of her artwork, and I could write, poems out of that. Joanna is also a poet herself.
Yes.
So it would be very, very interesting, for her to do that. But I am interested in that kind of conversation in terms of, how do you move from one medium to another? You know, what do you notice? What do you emphasize? What speaks to you? So those are questions that I like to ask her. Once she's done with the project, what does she learn about me as a poet, and how does that shape her as an artist? And those are questions that I've been thinking about, but have not sent her that, have not formulated them until now, until you asked me.
Yeah, she's probably going to be asked them twice, once by once by you and once by me. And I think even your idea of, if you take, a picture or a sketching and then say, okay, let me try to create a poem out of this. It's that kind of trying to translate, it's a process of translation of sorts. I mean, would a poem have a color? Would a poem have would it be the images? And if so, if it has an image, like, you know, is it the most powerful one? So,
yeah. Good. Yes. Let me know when that's on too.
I'll let you know when that's on, because we certainly have that. We got into the kind of why you create and some of the processes, and I think in part of the discussion around your teaching, but also writing poetry and creating art at the same time, I think it connects to my question is, do you think that there's a duty, if you have an artistic inclination, to work or to help create other artists, if that's what you're doing?
Absolutely. Not create other artists, but to support, to encourage. It's a very lonely world. It's a brutal world. the process itself is it's a lonely experience of thinking and writing and creating art. And then, of course, the rejection, not getting this publication or this award or that. And now, you know, we have, in a good way, and also in a bad way, so many poets out there. My job as a teacher and also as a friend is to encourage other writers and poets and artists. It's such a very a lonely and brutal world that we just need to let each other know that we're there for each other. And that's what I try to do, you know, on social media, whether it's Twitter or Facebook or what have you. And also what I try to do as a teacher at my college. I don't think I create them, but I like to push them. I like to encourage them. I like to expose them to different kind of poetic forms and voices and ways of presenting, ways of telling stories, ways of beginning and ways of ending, and what do you do with the middle part and so on. So my job is really, help them feel confident. Help them show the different ways of doing, of writing and thinking and acting in the world, and also I have friends, Clint Margrave and Tony Glocker and Alan Catlin, Alexa Rohn Fancher, what we do is we are nice to each other. We support each other by, sending an email out and say, I have this draft. Can you look it over? What are your thoughts? Ted Jonathan's another poet. All these people. The point is there is an obligation. If we don't support each other, who will? And the world doesn't see art, poetry, literature, humanities, as that significant. And that's just the way it is and the way it has been. But we are who we are. Whatever happened, early in our life, whatever happened, this is who we are. And what we can do, instead of being petty and jealous, we are encouraging, we are kind, we are generous. That's what I want to do, and that's what I've been trying to do with writers, friends, and poet friends, and students. Do what I can, and I lucked out. I have a lot of help from other poets and writers too. So I'm just passing the baton. I'm just passing it forward. An obligation, a duty to help other writers and poets. Absolutely.
Yeah, and poetry has a particular place for me. As the years go by, I had a heavy period of poetry, which can happen, in reading and writing it when I was younger, probably from, say 16 to, probably early to mid 20s. And then, other things happen or other art forms, and I didn't really pick up those volumes. And I think it was about 2 or 3 years ago, I was reading Bukowski's poetry, I was reading your stuff. There was Breakbeat Poets. I got the Poetry Magazine, and there's this incredible vibrancy that I just, like electricity, like that just jolted me again. And of course, we're at a time where we shared the same patch of earth over there at Amherst with Emily Dickinson. I didn't quite know as much about her. I've read enough of her poetry back then, but of course that's where we met back then. And so right now, when it comes to poetry itself, all the power that it had, or kind of I had moved away from or not connected myself with, a lot of that's back. And it's in particular that this form of art, poetry, is a big reason why I want to talked to a variety of artists, but of course, poets and of course you. Mm-hmm. When it comes to, you know, I mentioned some of that some names of some past poets in past history. One of the questions I ask my guests, which leads to why is there something rather than nothing, is a little bit more connected to the process. Do you view what you create as coming from nothing, that you've created, you've pulled it out of from wherever it was and created something, or do you view it a different way?
I would sort of, instead of like that either or dichotomy, I would see that there's a complementary relation between the two, from nothingness and from something. I think the stuff that happens, the earlier sort of work, it came out from the real world, from war and genocide, from this historical rupture where, you know, my family and other Cambodians are torn away from the motherland. We had to find refuge somewhere else. So it came out from that. But the creation of it, there's certain memories, but you have to construct that memory with, you know, by stringing up words together. So there's that, I think, the creative process. I think at the moment I'm moving away from narrative poetry, not completely, but also, you know, but at the same time, I am sort of trying to figure out ways to write. There's a wonderful book by Gregory Orr, I think that came out maybe 2 years ago, something called like a primer for poets and readers of poetry. And he talks about like the two strands of poetry. One is narrative, another one's lyrical. The lyric is, it's the way, it's much more abstract, and it sort of exemplifies the way the mind works, the creative mind. And so I think that in that sense is, you know, we're talking about the subconscious. We're talking about, you know, how we associate things, the way our mind sort of moves. So I think in that sense is, so there is that movement from something to nothingness, to the subconscious. I don't know what is the subconscious. Is that, you know, is that a nothingness, or is that also something that is repressed because society said that, you know, you can't think this way, you can't act this way, so it's all repressed and pushed further down into the subconscious. I don't know. But I think the creation itself is you are putting words together in a way that is new. So in that sense, it's a kind of nothingness.
Yeah, and I think, BK, you probably are a trained philosopher because you're asking me questions off the question. You got it down.
it's just teaching. That's what we do.
We ask questions. Yeah, absolutely. And I've always liked to ask questions, and I like to ask them in this format, because one of the things I've discovered in doing the podcast is that it just creates the extra avenues. I'm a verbal processor, and when those avenues open up, I kind of like to explore them with who I'm talking to. So the questions are just, they're really the prompt, and, you know, kind of keep things moving. You had mentioned the importance of music, and obviously an overlap between music and poetry and that connection is powerful, right? You listen to that song, in you know, the songs that save your life, the songs that you hold on to. And I know you've had that experience. I have too. And I've talked to other music fans, and they talk about that. And we had I think in general a lot of similar musical tastes, and one of them was the Smiths, and the kind of like that darker kind of lonelier outsider, and which of course was inhabited by Morrissey. And I've been asking Morrissey fans lately, because I think it's such a complicated question, is you got somebody who is an artist who's outspoken a vegan, who's beloved within the Mexican and Mexican American community with tribute bands in Espanol, and Irish English, and had identified more with his maybe part of his Irish part of his heritage of being the outsider. And then you have all these phenomenal songs that I and you and I love, both Smiths and the Morrissey, and we talk about them and quote them. And so you have all this art, and you have all these things that he produced, and then he has troubling is the most charitable way to put it. Comments around those of the Islamic faith, in Asians, and other groups that are at the least simply provocative or cryptic, and or at worst, some would say that an indictment is being racist. So, the two questions I have is one is what's your view on all this? And second, how does that view impact your connection to the music, to the music that you love?
That's a difficult question to answer. I remember some time ago, there was a record store that decided to stop selling Morrissey's albums because of his right-wing anti-immigrant, anti-Islam public sort of rhetorics, right? And I'm against censorship. Let him sell his albums. I understand that he's fanning the flames. I understand that he's, as a public figure, for him to say something like that, there's some, that people see that as a kind of validation of their views. I understand all of that. Being a person of color myself, representation is political, is loaded, and to have that negative portrayal in public, has not only a legal ramifications, but also psychological, in terms of how we feel about ourselves. With that said, I do think that. The Morrissey that I experienced was the Smith and the early Morrissey in the 1990s. And those were mine. Those songs were, I felt like they were speaking to me. I can't it doesn't taint me. It doesn't, that was sort of, there's a wonderful block response that Nick Cave wrote regarding this issue, and I think his sort of position is something like, you have to separate the art from the artist, and once the artist has his artwork out in public, it's no longer his. It's the audience who will make it theirs, and I feel that's very true from my perspective. That Morrissey, the Morrissey that I knew, That was they, you know, his music, his songs saved my life, really. I think the best way to sort of think about it is just separating that artwork from the artist. You don't want to sort of to censor and say the artist and say you can't do this, you can't do that. It's just very complicated as a person of color, but also as a writer. This is a challenging sort of question. I don't have easy answers, but I know that I do not want to go and cross over the line of censorship. That I don't want to. But I also think that, you know, as representation, you know, other people can speak against Morrissey. Other artists, other writers and poets and musicians, and the public, they can speak in response. But I don't think they should ever say, I'm going to take your record off. I can't, so that's sort of, there's a line there that I wouldn't cross. Does that make sense, Ken?
Yeah, that does make sense. And it's actually an active question. It's not the first time the question's been asked. It's the Roman Polanski's films, Woody Allen's movies. Is Annie Hall the same movie now that it was then? Is The Youth of Mariel Hemingway and, Manhattan problematic? I think it's a great... it's a great engaged question. And I also think that not to speak for you, but I think as far as some of the artists that, you and I are intrigued by, you're going to encounter some very powerful, very powerful reactions to what they do. I think of Bukowski I say Bukowski because, you have to deal with his drinking, you have to deal with his relationships, and what that means. But when you read, if you get Bukowski, you get Bukowski, and it's this kind of like jolt, this kind of quick, access to, I don't know whether it's anguish, joy, way of living, way of not living.
Again, that's another, I wrote an essay about my relationship with Bukowski. I think it's something called On Fathers, Losses, and Influences. And it's published on this website, this online magazine called Numero Zank, edited by Douglas Glover, a wonderful, smart Canadian writer. Bukowski, for me, as someone who's an outsider, I could relate to his stories. And I could understand. I feel like I'm at home because I was never at home when I was growing up in Malden. I was at home with Bukowski's world. And I didn't have a father figure. So Bukowski became a kind of a literary father figure for me. And I did find a sense of comfort, a sense of familiarity. It's like, oh, those are outsiders too, just like me. So I could relate, but I know that his relationships with women, the way he writes, the way he wrote about women, and his attitudes about immigrants, those were problematic. But I can't sort of deny and erase that moment when I encountered Bukowski and said, oh, I could relate. And because of Bukowski, I read other writers. Because of Bukowski, I knew of other writers. Because of Bukowski, I became a writer. So I can't really, even though he's controversial, he's Bukowski. The same thing with Morrissey. That those people shaped me and influenced me. They gave me another life. I can't deny that. I'm sure other people would, disagree, and there are bigger ways to, counter argue that. But at the moment, in a very spontaneous response, I mean, that's really, how I look at it. It would be false. I would be lying if I kind of denied Bukowski and said, oh, he's just a male white writer. Morrissey, the same thing. It's just a racist Brit or an Irishman. And that, I think, I would be untrue to myself to say that. I do see the problems, but also, I have to recognize that they were important to me, absolutely important to me. I don't remember the last time I bought a Morrissey album, probably in 2000 or something. but I can't deny that Morrissey was very important to me, and the Smith was. And I responded to the words, the lyrics of Morrissey over the guitar of Johnny Marr. And that's the initial moment. And the music, came in after. That's how I listened to music back then.
Yeah, and that's how that comes through. And I think it's always come through, I think, when we would talk is it hits you. And it's the power. It's that feeling. And, there is a paucity of words sometimes when you are trying to explain, like, how did that song make you feel? Or after reading that poem, what person were you after reading that poem? It's not. There's no a quick answer. And about poetry, and I asked this question because of just sheer interest and maybe an anecdotal impression, but. Is poetry becoming more popular? Is there a revival, or is poetry just kind of always been there, just in its space? What's going on with poetry right now?
I think there's an exciting, wonderful, frightening explosion especially with social media, with Instagram and Twitter. You have these young poets creating their own magazines and journals and publishing, and they're the old guard. It's they're gone. They're insignificant. Now you have these young kids doing it, and I think that's pretty exciting. I've been reading. I've been reading this summer with a student, Nick Slurry, contemporary poets, some of them are wonderful and very good. So there's definitely this explosion of wonderful stuff. But also there's because there's so many. Poets out there and writing all kinds of stuff. That is the market is it's flooded. It's we're inundated with poetry all over. So I don't know what's going to happen in the future in terms of hopefully. The good stuff will rise, and what does that mean anyway, in terms of the good stuff? I guess what it means is what I like. It's subjective, but I think at the moment it's pretty all over the place, and there's some good and there's some stuff where like, why is this poetry? You can just write it in prose paragraph form, and it's fine. And then there's other writers, young poets, who just the way they phrase things, the way they see the world, and so on. Anyway, I think it's very new. I think social media, Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. I think those forms are sort of really challenging traditional print, traditional, you know, it's decentered sort of the world publishing. So we'll see what's going to happen to it, you know. I'm going to just keep on writing. I write what I need to write, and I write what I love to write, and I'll just keep on going. And I've lucked out in terms of getting publications out there. I've been happy with that. But I, you know, I have a lot to learn as a writer, as a poet, and teaching is a great way to do that. A wonderful way to do that, to learn new things.
And of course, you said a third volume coming out. Your first volume was called Gruel, and the next one in So I Was Blessed. And of course, I've been calling you BK, but that's not what the name is on the book. Can you tell us how Wun Kang became BK?
Yeah. Well, you know, I assume people, you know, think that, you know, that I was trying to, or that it came out of a place where, you know, people who don't speak Khmer, who can't pronounce Wun Kang, kind of give me that nickname, that initial. But that wasn't the case. Back in the 1990s, I was an undergraduate at Cal State Long Beach, and I was also a kind of an assistant editor to this wonderful friend for this journal called Khmer Voice in Poetry. The friend's name, his name is Tibet Munkusam, and he's Khmer. And, you know, the two of us were working together, creating this journal where we publish Cambodian American writings, poetry, song, stories, anything, because we felt like there was a need. There was, number one, there was an absence of Khmer Americans interested in the arts and humanities. They wanted to create a space for that where, you know, anyone who's interested in it can submit their work and we edit and publish it. Anyway, Tevret, he calls me BK. And it just it got stuck, and now my daughter, she knows me as BK. I haven't told her my real name yet. So it came out of this sort of friendship, really. It didn't come out of some non-Cambodian speakers call me this and it gets stuck. It was a Khmer person, so I really wanted to emphasize that it came out of friendship. Really,
and phonetically, is after the K in the first name, sound more or less a W sound there. Bun Kuang.
Bun Kuang, yeah. Bun Kuang. Yeah. Anyway, it's all, you know, it's all good. But when I do write, I like my name to be printed next to the work. But I think, you know, everybody knows me as BK now. I think, and I'm good with that because it was my choice to keep that out of that sort of, you know, honor for that friend. So it just sticks. It didn't come out of any negative sort of moment there. Thanks for asking that as an opportunity for me to clarify that sort of that narrative.
Yeah. Absolutely. And so what about the next collection of poetry? Anything you want to say about that, when that's coming?
It's going to be the end of this year, it's a book of poems that trace the beginning of being a father to, now my daughter is about 4 years old. So it was like, you know, from zero to three or so, these poems that document, the anxiety of being a father, the anxiety of being a father to a girl and not a boy, and they're, you know, being a father is political, you know, and you know, you pay attention to the way the world is now in terms of how women are treated and are expected to do this, to do that, the inequalities, the oppression. So I'm all like, you know, worry about this, and you know, as a father yourself, you have a daughter, I think you know what I'm talking about. So the poems all have to deal with my daughter and with Trump America, to put it bluntly. So there's social political elements in addition to, you know, just raising a daughter. Does that make sense there?
Yeah,
I'm pretty excited about it.
Absolutely. It does sound great. And like I said, you can connect that through the specific poems in the past. And I know some that you post. They are incredible. But the piece that I like most about them is not any, you know, just kind of like easy sense that that put you at ease. And there are aspects of many of your poems that do that. Mm-hmm. I think it has to do with the questions that you're asking in there, the things you're trying to interrogate in order to understand experience and to pull what you can from. And I think that's a huge, huge motivation between our, and I think that's why the conversations that I've recorded thus far on the podcast, you know, yes, it's philosophy. Yeah, it's art. And then there's a ton of psychology, right? There just is, in questioning and trying to figure out, there's some, very similar processes that are going on. Definitely look forward to that. Before I let you go, the question, the podcast in general, and I know I asked it in a different way, but BK, why is there something rather than nothing? Why is there anything?
Well, nothing is for me nirvana. No attachment. But we're alive. You know, this is the way life is. There's something, and there's something is good, even though at times painful. But I think overall it's good, and I like the something. I like it now. I like, you know, the stuff that's happening in terms of being a father and having a daughter and all that stuff, and being a teacher, being something is good at the moment. And I hope to hold on to that view. It is good. Okay. I don't know if that answers the title of your podcast, but it is. Life is good. Nothing is really, I don't know what it is. I think we came out of nothingness, maybe, and we're going to go back. But I like what we have now. I suffered early on, but then, I was saved. I was rescued. And now I just want to continue doing what I do and also help others as best as I can.
Yeah, and I really appreciate that. And I just want to tell you, BK, it's just been a great pleasure, you know, for me, to be able to catch up with you, but also to be involved in, this podcast and these questions that I'm asking. Part of the reason why I'm doing it is in asking the questions, I'm just like generally interested in where it leads. And I've always considered you a good friend. It's good to reconnect with you. And I just want to thank you for your time, and very much look forward to the next, you know, your next volume. But I also know you do some intermittent publishing, you know, get some of the poems out there. I look forward to that as well. But best of luck with everything, and thank you so much being on the podcast.
It's quite a pleasure, Ken. I really wish we could do more of this, not just for the podcast, but just to catch up. And how far are you from Portland?
About 10 minutes just outside of Portland.
Oh, man.
Happy. You
gotta figure out if there's a conference, a writing conference or scholarly conference that I could sort of go to and meet you. It's been a long time.
Absolutely. That'd be fantastic. Portland, and you know some of Portland. It'll be great to see you again, and a real thrill to connect back with you, BK, and enjoy the rest of your vacation too. It's I know you work hard. It's well deserved.
Oh, thank you, man. Thank you. All right, you take good care.
Thanks, brother.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You are listening to Something Rather Than Nothing.